All right, good morning. We got two people here.
Mark might show up, yeah, he's always
If there's any edits, can you record them today?
Yeah, I saw some of the issues you asked me.
Thanks. All right, well, Mike's in the hospital.
Yeah.
I've talked to him, so Mike, hopefully you might be watching this. We send our greetings to you there. Mike's in the hospital. AJ and Lisa went on vacation down south and apparently just missed getting hit with this major storm. They went to the Asheville, North Carolina area to visit the Biltmore estate. At least that was their plan, last I knew. And apparently they got out of there before the... It's just terrible what's happening down in East Tennessee and West North Carolina. I have some friends down there, and apparently, like, the dams broke, or they were breached. And so it wasn't just the rain. It was just, I think there's still some maybe inaccuracies or not full information as far as all the details on some of that stuff. But it's not good at all what's going on down there. So we need to definitely keep those folks in our prayers. All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. You should have in front of you a set of notes for Lesson 240. Lesson 240, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, the 1638 Cambridge Edition. If you're following along with us online, if you want to go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, you can scroll down under Recent Sermons, click on the link today for September 29. And you should be able to load the notes that we're going to be using here in class and follow along with us. I'm going to go ahead and do that because there's some stuff I'm going to want to show on the screen. So let's get started with Lesson 240, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, the 1638 Cambridge Edition. Introduction. Excuse me. In Lesson 239, we continued our look at the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. In doing so, we consider the following points. So this is just some review here. Number one, I gave a research update on the acquisition of a 1633 Edinburgh Octavo in Roman font, H475. From this, we observed that Edinburgh was printing a mixed text containing some London as well as Cambridge readings. Therefore, there were at least three lines of text being published during the 1630s. The London text, the Cambridge text, and now the Edinburgh text, which contain London and Cambridge readings, okay? Now, before we go any further, this isn't in the notes, but I just want to touch on this briefly, okay? Since last week, we have been able to locate, this is a 1642, and if you guys look at this picture that I have up here on the screen, you can go down and see this is from Amsterdam. So I've been able to locate, with the help of Alex, a 1642 Amsterdam printing. And I want to zoom in here on this briefly. Notice what it says. The Holy Bible containing the Old and New Testaments, newly translated out of the original tongues, and with the former translations diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special commandment. So this is a King James Bible. But then look at this. With most profitable annotations upon all the hard places and other things of great importance, which notes have never before been set forth with this new translation. So what this is an Amsterdam printing of the King James Bible from 1642 that has the Geneva Bible notes in the margin. So in the 1640s, Amsterdam is going to begin to print the text. Okay. Now we've been tracking with a couple verses that we've sort of just been using to keep track of this. So I want to use this to zoom in on a couple of these verses. The first one is the one from Genesis chapter 8, verse 13. So by the way, before I zoom in too close, so this is the King James text, and all this stuff in the margin are the same notes that you would find in a Geneva Bible. Okay? But if you zoom into verse 13 here, notice how it reads. Okay? Notice.
Brian,
what?
You got a blank screen here. Black screen.
On YouTube?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Is the camera turned on?
Yeah. What about Facebook?
Look.
So it's completely black?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I might have to start over again. Do we have a...
I don't see anything live on Facebook. On the church channel, right? Let me look on yours.
No, look on mine.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Good.
We're not live there either, are we? I am live there. Why am I not live on Facebook? I'm sorry, YouTube. Are the people on YouTube saying they got nothing?
No.
So if I go...
It's just my phone. Let me read a little bit.
No, we're live. Not this. Yeah. Is I'm looking at myself right now.
Okay.
Hi, yeah, self.
I wonder if my phone was.
Anyway, sorry about all that, folks. So what was I talking about?
You were just talking about getting ready to read that one.
Oh, I'm talking about the Amsterdam text, right? Okay. So one of the verses we've been following to kind of track with all this is Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 13. Okay. So notice what it says here. So I'm reading from the Amsterdam edition from 1642. And it came to pass in the 601st year. So 601st year, that is the same reading in that verse that the Cambridge text had. Okay. Then we can look at another example, the infamous verse now that has created all the hullabaloo of Job 4:6. Let's go look at that. So here is Job, and here's verse 4:6, and notice what it says. It says, is not this, is and this, being in italics, thy fear, comma, thy confidence, semicolon, which still is a slight difference, and the uprightness of thy ways, thy hope. So notice that the thy hope is still dangling at the end, right? So the Amsterdam text is again a mixed text. It reads like London in Job 4:6, but it reads like Cambridge in Genesis chapter 8, verse 13. And if you guys recall from last week, the Edinburgh text was the exact opposite of what we're now seeing in the Amsterdam text. So we can say, based upon objective evidence at this point, that there are four forms of the text. So even this point right here probably needs to be updated before I publish the final copy of the notes based upon further information. Having now looked at a 1642 Amsterdam text, there are now four forms of the text. There's a London, a Cambridge, an Edinburgh, and now an Amsterdam in the 1640s. That contains London and Cambridge readings, but they're flipped around from what we saw in the Edinburgh one from last week. So, like I say and have said many times throughout this study, this is why this issue of verbatim identicality versus verbal equivalence is such a big deal. Because you have all these different forms of the text that are being published, and I still don't know when exactly they sort of came together into a standard form. That is a matter that has yet to be determined. Okay, so getting back to the notes, so all that again is new. So stuff is happening every week lately as far as finding and seeing new things. Okay, and in fact, I didn't have time to update these notes before I sent them off to be proofread. Otherwise, I would have included this as another research update in these particular notes. So let's go back to page one. So we were tracking or reviewing what we saw in lesson 239 from last week. So we had the research update. I now just gave you another brief research update above and beyond that. So, and we looked at the example of Ezekiel 3:11 last time. We talked about the spelling of names, and then we looked at some issues related to italics in the Cambridge 1638 Cambridge Bible. Okay. So that brings us now to this lesson. In this lesson, we will conclude our discussion of the 1638 Cambridge edition with a focus mostly on spelling. At the end, there's an appendix containing a couple more examples of editorial changes made by the 1638 editors. Okay, so are we still good there as far as...
Yeah.
Okay. So 1638 Cambridge folio edition. Much is made in our day regarding the spelling of certain words in the King James Bible. Okay? Some argue that words like ensample and example are wholly different words of discriminated meaning. Others assert that spellings must be exact to convey the exact sense. Still others maintain that American spellings, as opposed to traditional British spellings, divest Scripture of its fullest understanding. So if you spell labor without the U, if you spell Savior without the U, if you spell any of these words without the U, there are some that are going to argue that those are now somehow corrupted spellings. Okay? So when Americans begin to print the text, shortly after we secure independence from the British Crown, I've made this point many times, it's in my book, The King James Bible in America, American publishers start to conform the text to American spellings. Okay, where they're doing things like dropping the U on labor, just as one example. Okay, so some people are going to say that that's a corruption. The problem with that to me is if that's a corruption, then you're going to have to falsify thousands of King James Bibles that are printed in North America, you know, during the 19th century, which to me just is... It's an unnecessary position, and it leads to ridiculous conclusions, okay? And so, but spelling sort of becomes almost like a sacred cow, if you will, in some of this discussion, where if something is spelled a certain way, then it becomes, you know, people kind of get almost, in my opinion, superstitious about some of this stuff. But that's my perception. I don't think... there's any difference between spelling labor with a U versus not spelling labor with a U, okay? You know my thoughts already on ensample example. I'm not going to get into great detail on that. I've talked about that in detail other places. But the point here is this. Spelling becomes an issue for a lot of people, all right? According to Dr. David Norton, the spelling of words in the AV first became a topic of discussion around 1660 when William Curl Kilburn authored his piece, Dangerous Errors in Several Late Printed Bibles to the Great Scandal and Corruption of Sound and True Religion. Regarding this point, Norton writes, quote, top page 2, the problem of the spelling of the Bible was not raised until roughly 1660 when a standard copy of the King James Bible was proposed that should be, quote, for orthography so truly and clearly written, and hereafter a letter shall not be altered. So in other words, you can't change a single what? So 1660 is roughly the time when this starts to become a real question, you know, as far as the spelling of words. And Kilburn is bringing this up. And he's also going to mention it in a second thing called Humble Proposals. McKitterick covers this in his piece, and this appears to be like a petition to the British Parliament to intervene to manage the printing of Bibles so that there's a standard orthography. Orthography deals with spelling, okay, and how these Bibles are being printed. Now notice what he says next. This does not signal the arrival of the idea that there was or should be standard English spelling. Rather, it harks back to Jewish care to keep the Hebrew text pure. Quote, the Jews were so accurate that they knew the number of words, syllables, nay, letters in every book, whose diligence and industry in the kind God's providence hath used as a means to keep the scriptures from corruption. Now, and I have a note here that my copy of Kilburn reads slightly differently, but the substance is the same. So I've shared with you that digital copy of Kilburn. The wording is a little bit different than what Norton is quoting here, but it's saying the same thing. Okay. Occasionally, the number of letters in the King James Bible has been a matter of curiosity. Now, I'm just going to stop there for a minute. This is an issue in our day. Okay. I can think of some people who will use Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and the last verse in the book of Revelation to say that there's the same number of words, the same number of vowels, the same number of consonants in Genesis 1, 1 and Revelation chapter, let's see, what's the verse number? What's the last verse? the number escapes me off the top of my head. Revelation 22, verse 21. And they'll say, this is proof that the King James Bible is, you know, the inspired word of God, because there's the same number of words, same number of vowels, same number of consonants in Genesis 1:1 and Revelation chapter 22, verse 21. Now, Norton's not talking about that, but when he's talking about that the number of letters in the King James Bible has been a matter of curiosity, that fits, that kind of thinking fits with what he's talking about, okay? Now, just be honest about it. For me, I don't put a lot of stock in those types of numerological arguments, okay? Partly because I've seen what happens in the spelling and in a lot of the stuff that we've been looking at. So I'm not going to stake my claim to the, you know, authority of the King James Bible on these types of arguments. Now, there are others who do. There are folks who have taken, you know, there's videos on YouTube of people who have taken Bible software and run search analysis on the words and have concluded that there's, you know, they've done all this math to figure out that, you know, as proof that the King James Bible is in fact the Word of God. I would just simply say to that stuff, what verse tells anybody to do that? Like, what verse says to do that? There isn't one, okay? And so I don't think those arguments personally are very helpful in the end, because they're not arguments that anybody could make before the 21st century and the advent of Bible search software analysis and stuff like this. So I just don't find them to be persuasive, okay? So you'll be surprised how much hate mail I'm going to get over saying that, but I don't find it to be persuasive. I don't think the plowboy cares about that, no. I think the plowboy cares that he has God's word in his language and so forth, okay? So let's get back to this point. Occasionally, the number of letters in the King James Bible has been a matter of curiosity, but in general, the spelling of the KJV has followed, here it is, tardily, that means what? Slowly, right? The progressive standardization of English and American spelling. So in other words, has the King James text lagged behind the changes in orthography that have occurred in English? That's essentially what Norton is saying, right? The tardiness comes largely from conservative reverence for the text. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with conservative reverence for the text, okay? But you can go too far with that, it seems to me, and start getting into these numerological arguments and all these sorts of things, okay? With the result that into the 21st century, inconsistencies and old-fashioned spellings remain. So that's Norton's opinion, okay? I don't care if Americans changed spelling of certain words. I don't think that divested American printings of the King James Bible of anything other than just their Americanizing what? Spelling, okay? Now, there are people that are going to disagree with me about that, but here's sort of my thinking on that. One of the main arguments that King James advocates use is they'll say, well, I'm going to grab a random number here just to make the illustration. I don't know off the top of my head what the exact number is, but they'll say, well, let's just say there were 50 million printings of the King James Bible, and many of these were published between 1800 and 1900 during the great wave of mission work that British and American missionaries, they took the King James Bible all around the world and on their missionary work in Asia and Africa, throughout the Polynesian areas and all this stuff, and they take the King James Bible with them. And so one of the main arguments that King James defenders make is they say, well, the King James Bible goes all around the world and it influences all of these cultures. Well, if you start looking at that, a high number of those are going to be American publishings that are taken by American missionaries that are furnished by the American Bible Society that have American spellings in them. So now are we going to say that all of these Bibles taken around the world by American missionaries are illegitimate Bibles because they spell words the way words are spelled in America? That seems too far. That's too far for me to go. I can't go there. Okay. It seems like not an argument that we should be necessarily entertaining. So if I understand Norton and the sources that he cited properly, the concern regarding English spelling was born out of acknowledging the care and concern that Hebrews put into the preservation of their texts. While the McKitterick quote seems very specific, it is doubtful that uniformity in spelling was ever accomplished before the development of modern printing technologies. This is especially true when one factors in the American printings of the King James Bible during the late 18th and 19th centuries. For more information on this topic, interested parties are encouraged to check out my book, The King James Bible in America, an Orthographic, Historical, and Textual Investigation. If you want to find the King James Bible printed with absolute uniformity before computers, let's just even say, I think you're going to struggle to do that. Okay, I just do. And I think some of the evidence that we furnished already in this class demonstrates that, not to mention the American printings. So Norton goes on to state the following regarding spelling in the Cambridge Folio editions of 1629 and 1638. Quote, through the first century and a half of the life of the King James Bible text, all one can observe is fitful movement towards modern spelling and consistency in spelling. Some examples from the Cambridge editions will be enough to show that they constituted only a small step towards the modern and consistent. The first edition did not distinguish between naught, N-A-U-G-H-T, and naught, N-O-U-G-H-T, but the 1638 editors did. Using naught with the A there, okay, where there is implication of evil or naughtiness, okay? Naught with the O, where the implication is nothingness, okay? At 2 Kings 2:19, they substitute naught in the water is naught and the ground barren, bringing out the Hebrew word for bad or evil. So they make a change in the spelling to try to accentuate that the Hebrew word there is expressing evil or bad or naughty or wicked, that kind of a thing, right? Conversely, set him at naught, Luke chapter 23, verse 11, becomes set him at naught, naught being spelled with the O, reflecting the Greek, made him as nothing, humiliated him, okay? These changes are unique among the 1629 and 1638 spellings in the way they are dictated by the original. So what is Norton saying? He's saying that the Cambridge editors, they choose a specific spelling because they feel it is better reflecting either the Hebrew or the Greek what? Word. Okay? Does everybody follow that?
Yeah.
So, once again, bottom of page 2, Norton is saying that the 1638 Cambridge editors had recourse to the original languages when deciding how to spell the English words not with the A and not with the O. One, they reserved for when the sense was evil or naughty, not with the A. The other, for when the sense was empty or nothingness, not with the O. Let's look at a couple of examples. So here we go. Let's actually track with his examples. Okay. So here's 2 Kings 2:19. Okay. Here's the 1611. How do they spell it?
O.
With the O, okay? But the water is naught and the ground barren. And they spelt it with what? The O. Okay. Here's the 1638 Cambridge Folio. Notice, okay? But the water is naught with what? The A instead of the O and the ground barren. All right? So, look at my bullet point there. This is another case where Norton missed the mark by not checking the lesser Cambridge printings from the 1630s. I was able to locate this reading in the following printings before 1638. So when I did my analysis, I found not spelled with an A in Cambridge printings from a 1637 Cambridge Quarto and Roman font, H513, and a 1637 Cambridge Quarto and black letter font, H157. So, was that spelling change made by a Cambridge editor before 1638? Shake your head yes, because that's the answer, okay? So, in 2 Kings 2:19, the Hebrew word revised The Hebrew word revised to read not with the A by the Cambridge editors is the word ra, which means bad, evil, as an adjective, and evil, distress, misery, injury, calamity, as a noun. And that's according to the lexicographical information by Blue Letter Bible's lexicon, okay? The use of not with the A to imply evil as opposed to nothingness was not a distinction that had been made by the King James translators. They just spelled it with what? With an O and not with what? An A. So what Norton is saying is this change in spelling is being driven by looking where? At the Hebrew. Okay? The Hebrew word is a word for bad or evil. So they changed the spelling to spell not with an A to indicate evil, naughtiness, distress, this type of a thing. This is what Norton is saying. Okay? Any questions about that?
Well, how is it spelled in the dictionary? How does that pan out in the dictionary? Do they have two separate words with different meanings?
So I think this is an example of what we're talking about here, right? I think there began to become a convention that not, because the King James Bible also uses the word naughty or naughtiness, and it's spelled with what? An A. Okay? So there seems to be an editorial concern here to capture that consistency by spelling it with what? With an A. Now, I think if you were to look it up in a dictionary from the time, you could see that possibly they could be used interchangeably, this different spellings. But the Cambridge editor seemed to be making this change. Now, so we've only looked at one example. Let's look at a couple more to see if this checks out, or we can at least give a little bit more evidence, okay? Look at Proverbs chapter 20, verse 14. Now, this is not one discussed by Norton, okay? This is one that I found on my own by just doing some digging. So look at it. Proverbs 20, verse 14. It is not. How is not spelled here? With an O. Okay, and the 1611 is spelled with an O. Go to top page 4. Here's the 1638 Cambridge Folio. And notice how is not spelled?
With an A.
Okay? So once again, the following lesser Cambridge printings contain the change to not with an A at Proverbs 20, verse 14, before the 1638 Cambridge Folio edition. So we're talking about the same two, the 1638 Cambridge Quarto in Roman font, H513, and the 1637 Cambridge Quarto in black letter, H514. Both of these change the spelling of not from the 1611 spelling that had an O to the new spelling that has what? A. It's not a new spelling, but they change the way the word is spelled. Okay? Any questions? Now, if we look deeper into this, so look at the next bullet there. As in the last example, the Hebrew word in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 14 is once again ra, thereby indicating evil or what? Naughtiness. So that's two examples now of them changing a spelling based upon a specific Hebrew word and spelling it with an A instead of an O because of what seems to be a desire to capture that verse different. Now, let's look at the reverse example, okay? Luke chapter 23, verse 11. Here's the 1611. Notice, and Herod with his men of war set him at naught. Naught spelled with what? An A in the 1611, okay? Then look at Cambridge, 1638. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at what? Not spelled with what? An O. Okay? This change originated, so this one does originate with the 1638 edition. I checked the following lesser Cambridge editions from the 1630s and could not locate the spelling in question until 1638. This is another instance, let's go with that, where Norton was correct as to when the change in spelling occurred in the Cambridge text. So these are all of the ones that I looked at, okay? 1629 Cambridge Folio, 1630, 1631, 33, 32 from 37, okay? None of these Cambridge printings had made that change from not with an A to not with an O, all right? So, there seems to be then, by these Cambridge editors, an emphasis on looking at something like this, okay? So, and Herod with his men of war set him at what? Not. Let's look at, everybody take your Bible, turn to Luke 23. Luke 23, look at verse 11. Luke 23, verse 11, in your standard 1769 text, notice, and Herod, with his men of war, set him at what?
Not.
And how is not spelled?
No.
With an O and not an A. Let's go back and look at just some of these other ones. We should have done this before, and I forgot to do it. Quickly, grab Proverbs 20, verse 14. We'll just do this for one of these. Grab Proverbs 20, verse 14. Proverbs 20, verse 14. Notice what it says. It is not, it is not. How's not spelled?
With an A.
With an A. Uh-oh. Yours is with an O?
Yep.
How's yours spelled, Bart?
Which was the verse?
We're in Proverbs 20, 14.
20, 14. It is not with an A.
Okay, so the A's,
it's not with an A.
Huh?
Did he say it's not with an A? Is that what he just said?
Yeah.
It's not with an A.
So the standard reading became not with what?
An A.
An A. Now you have one with an O. So let's talk about that. Uh-oh.
Burn.
So does he have an illegitimate Bible?
No.
I'm not willing to say no.
It's not.
It's not.
It's not.
Okay.
It just has to do with, like I said, this is Regency Publishing. It just depends on who printed
depend,
it.
In modern times, it's going to depend on who's publishing it. Okay.
When did England give up the rights to the Bible?
So that they have not.
Oh, they haven't. So.
They have not. So that's a great question. I cover this in my book, The King James Bible in America. What happens is, so when the 13 original colonies were still under the jurisdiction of the crown, the King James text was not printed on American shores. Okay? It was not until we declared independence that we began our, when I say we, I mean Americans, we began our first attempt to print the text. And it was undertaken by a guy named Aiken, and he does it during the Revolution. But once we secure independence, we're not under the authority of the jurisdiction of the British Crown, Americans just start printing the text. Okay, and we just Americanize the spellings for American readers, right? Meanwhile, the one on Amsterdam was not a crown sanctioned printing. No, they were not printing cum privilegio, is the Latin phrase, or with privilege. They were doing it as an economic venture to make what?
Money.
To make money. So they publish a King James text with Geneva notes. Why? Because there were a lot of people that still liked the Geneva notes, but they wanted the new translation. Okay. Now the crown, I'm not aware of. So I got to caveat that a little bit. I'm not aware of a crown sanctioned printer who did that. But the Amsterdam publishing doesn't have a problem with it because they're not under the crown's authority. So even to this day, Bart, in the 21st century, Cambridge and Oxford are still printing the text with royal license.
Okay.
So the text is still under the crown patent to print anywhere under the crown's authority. Okay.
Did England try to clamp down on to keep from Amsterdam books coming over?
You mean, was there economic sanctions against those? It's a great question. I don't know about that at this time.
Was it illegal? I mean,
they had 100% tariffs on it.
I'm sure there was an economic tariff. I'm sure.
They could say, hey, you're not allowed to be doing what you're doing, so we're going to ban you from importing them.
There's quite a few printings of it. Somebody was making money on it. I don't know all the details of if there were any restrictions placed on it, but they're clearly imported texts. The first English Bible, William Tyndale's, was imported because it was illegal to print the Bible in English. So there's a long history of, you know, continental publishers printing the English Bible and then being sort of brought into the English market through importation. But Amsterdam is willing to acknowledge a market that existed for the King James text, but with the Geneva notes. And so they print those and are willing to step into that space. And I don't know offhand exactly how many they sold. I would be interested to find out, but I don't know the answer to that. Okay. So, but this is a classic example. Okay. His Bible spells it with an O. Mine spells it with an A. And so does everybody else's. Okay? The Cambridge editors, did they clearly change the spelling of that word in that verse? They clearly did. Okay? And it's consistent with what Norton seems to be establishing as the reason for doing it. So, not with the A is confined to instances where the idea is evil, wickedness, naughtiness. Not with the O is confined to places, it seems, where the idea is nothingness. All right? So top page 5. Norton continues his discussion of spelling changes in the Cambridge editions by stating the following on page 94 of A Textual History of the King James Bible, quote, "A few words were consistently given modern spelling, as in the 1629's regulation of burden, or no, yeah, burden for burthen." So the B-U-R-H-E-N. So this spelling right here, this is the old spelling of what?
Burden.
Burden. Murder for murther. Okay? So this would have been the way that murder was spelled, and they're standardizing the spelling to what? This spelling here, the way that we would understand it or use it today. Then he goes into the complexities of entreat, E-N, versus entreat, I-N, okay, a continuing problem, are more expressive of the times. The first edition uses entreat with an I 59 times and entreat with the E 29. 1629 changes entreat with the E to entreat with the I 9 times and makes the reverse change 13 times. So they obviously see some reason for doing that in their judgment, right? There seems to be an attempt in this to keep the spellings consistent where the variants are near each other. But overall, I suspect there is a tendency to change simply because neither spelling seems exactly right. So in other words, it could have been one way, it could have been the other way, and there doesn't seem to be any real rhyme or reason for it. Where something seems slightly wrong, a change feels like a correction. 1638 follows 1629, except for making one more change of each sort, so adding to the sense of confusion. In footnote 25 on page 94, Norton lists all the changes made to entreat with the E to entreat with the I by the 1630 by the Cambridge editors. So I gave you a screenshot of that. Here's footnote 25 from page 94. We're not going to go through all of this, but here's the data for you if you want to look at it. So these are examples here of entreat with the E being changed to entreat with what? The I. And here are the examples of entreat with the I being changed to entreat with what? An E. Okay? So you can see that, like, there's a whole bunch of that sort of thing going on, and it doesn't really, at least from Norton's judgment, seem to be any kind of rhyme or reason for it. I did spend some time looking at it myself, running all of these, And I mean, I can't really make any sense out of it either. So I'm just going to leave it there. It's something that happened. I don't know that I fully understand why it happened or how or what their thinking was in that. Okay. Any questions?
Well, I mean, that wouldn't be like, well, entry means this, and then entry with an I means that. Just like, you know, naughty from nothing.
There does not seem to be. So in the example with not with the O versus not with the A, there seems to be a clear example of contextual decision based upon the underlying text for how that should work out. When I spent some time looking at this for entreat, I could not observe any sort of similar pattern, and Norton doesn't seem to be either. Okay? Does that make sense?
Were there standard dictionaries like the Webster's before? I don't think Webster's came until after this time.
So there were early dictionaries. By the time there was a dictionary, the first...
Was there much distinction on some of these words in those dictionaries?
Not like there is now. But there, in 1597, a guy named Edmund Cudi published what he called the English Schoolmaster. He talked about grammar. So this was a book that would have been used to teach basic writing and grammar and stuff like this at that time. And at the end of that book, he gives a list of hard words. I didn't check that to see if any entreat or entreat were in that list, but there's that. In 1604, a guy named Robert Cundry wrote a dictionary called the Table Alphabetical, which was an expansion over what Edmund Cudi had done in 1597. But by the time you get to the 1630s, yeah, I think you're starting to see some more dictionaries that are starting to come out. But there were dictionaries in place in a rudimentary sense when the King James translators did their work between 1604 and 1611.
I was just wondering if some of these were trying to convey a certain meaning, like the not and not.
Like I say, if it could be that is the case. If it is, it's not immediately clear to me.
Okay.
So I'm sure the internet will correct me on this too, I have no doubt. So in the final paragraph in the section on spelling, Norton addresses the standardization of some now archaic words in the Cambridge editions. He says, quote, "Finally, a few archaic words are given a new form." Okay? So broided becomes broided. All right? So what's that?
I'm just trying to pronounce it out.
So we have a different... So it seems like the only difference here is what? There's an R here.
Yeah.
So everybody go to 2 Timothy 2:9. No, 1 Timothy 2:9. First Timothy 2:9. Notice how it's talking about the women in modest apparel. And notice the broided does not have the extra R in it, right? So it's B-R-O-I-D-E-D, right? The 1611 had broided. This is a little confusing to me how he's got this. But mine doesn't have an R here. Does anyone's?
No.
Bart, do you have an R here after the D?
No.
So this becomes the standard spelling. Another one he gives is happily. So go to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. And look at 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 4. Notice, lest happily. 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 4. Lest happily, mine is spelled H-A-P-L-Y. Happily. Who's got that spelling? Happily. Okay.
That's like happenstance, right? It's not happily.
Yeah, lest happily if they of Macedonia come with me. I don't think it means, I think happily, it's a great question. Let's see if we can drill into that a little bit. We'll just use Webster just because it's easy. And come on. Happily, by chance, perhaps. So what you said about happenstance, yeah, by accident is the idea here with this word. Okay. Happily, or however you want to say it the other way, would indicate more of a what?
Joy.
Joy or happy kind of a thing. Okay. So apparently there was some you know difference there as far as the meaning. Now look at the next one. This one is from the Apocrypha, but Second Esdras. Look at the old spelling of since. So you got the old spelling there of since is now changed to since the way we understand it now, or the way it's spelled now. Okay. And from 1638, astrologians becomes astrologers in Daniel chapter 2, verse 27. Such changes run a fine line between changes of spelling and changes to the translator's English, and that is Norton's opinion. Okay? So you can look more at that if you want. Does anybody have any questions? Now, Gordon Campbell notes a printer's error in Jeremiah chapter 34, verse 16. In the 1638 Cambridge that was carried forward into later editions. He says, quote, in Jeremiah 34, verse 16, for example, the 1611 text printed, whom ye had set at liberty. The 1638 Cambridge introduced the misprint, whom he had set at liberty, which survived into editions of the KJV into the 20th century. So let's look at that one. Go to Jeremiah 34, verse 16. Jeremiah 34, verse 16. Jeremiah 34, verse 16. Notice, but ye turned and polluted my name and caused every man, his servant, and every man his handmaiden, whom ye had set at liberty. Okay, so so the 1611 correctly printed whom ye had set at liberty, and then notice the misprint was to say whom he had what. So that's a typo. That's a misprint. That's a printer's error, right? To say he there instead of ye. The standard reading is what? Ye, not what? Not he. Okay, so Campbell gives us that one.
I've got a bad Bible.
Huh?
I said I've got a bad Bible.
Yours says he?
Yeah.
It's not, but that's consistent with what Campbell says here, right? He said, look at the last line of what he says, bottom of page 5, which survived into editions of the KJV into the 20th century. Okay?
21st century
now, apparently, as well. So okay. Just think about this for a second. What has just happened here within 1 hour of looking at this? We have already observed that Eli has one Bible in one verse that has he instead of ye. And we've seen that that Mike has one that spells not with an O and not with what? An A. So if somebody's going to get so sort of bent out of shape about this, then they're going to have to declare and decide who has the correct one. Okay? Well, now, of course, it's me, because mine has it both right in both spots. Calm down. That was a joke. Okay? All right, let's go to the conclusion. Despite some of its minor deficiencies, the 1638 Cambridge text became the standard for over 100 years. That's the main point here, okay? The 1638 Cambridge became the standard text for over 100 years. A 1645 Dutch edition advertised itself on its title page as being printed, quote, according to the copy printed by Roger Daniel, printer, that should say printer, to the University of Cambridge. According to the copy is essentially tiny type on the New Testament page, making it apparent that the edition itself is printed by Daniel. William Bentley, who challenged the monopoly holders with several editions from 1646, on printed a text corrected by the Cambridge Bible only. So the idea here is, does the Cambridge Bible become the standard measuring stick for over 100 years as far as what is going to be considered proper? Okay. Harold P. Scanlon is the author of an essay titled Revising the KJV 17th through 19th Century in the anthology. There should be a end of a quotation mark after 19th century. In the anthology, The King James Version at 400, Assessing Its Genius as Bible Translation and Its Literary Influence. In this essay, Scanlon states the following regarding the 1638 Cambridge edition. So he gives the statistics or the details, 1638 Cambridge Folio Herbert 520, completing the task of the 1629 project, the authentic corrected Cambridge Bible endeavored to make the use of italics more uniform. They also made some translational exegetical changes. For example, is not this the son of David? For is this in Matthew 12, 23? We'll look at that in a minute. They added of God to hath not the son in 1 John 5, 12. Whom ye may appoint, for whom we may appoint in Acts 6, 3. Gordon Campbell offers the following summation regarding the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. He says, quote, the Cambridge edition of 1638 remained influential unto the late 18th century when an Oxford edition displaced it and established the modern text. So that would be the 1769 Oxford text. And A.S. Herbert, editor of the Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961, summarized the influence of the 1638 Cambridge as follows. This remained the standard text until the publication of Dr. Paris's Cambridge edition in 1762. Okay? So that's Herbert. So, is the 1638 Cambridge text an influential text? It's going to be the standard from basically 1638 until 1762 when it's edited again by Paris at Cambridge and then a few years later in 1769 by Blaney at Oxford, okay? So let's go, we have time to do this briefly, so go grab appendix on page 8. So Scanlon mentioned a couple that I threw into this appendix, okay? So other examples of edits in the 1638 Cambridge Folio Edition. So here is the bishops, 1602 bishops. Notice what it says. And this is Matthew 12, 23. Is not this the son of David? So does it have the word not in it? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Look at the 1611. Is this the son of David? What's not in the 1611?
No.
The word not. Okay, 1638 Cambridge, is not this the son of David, is not put back in. So not is reinserted back. It had been in the 1602 bishops. It's placed back in here. So let's look at this. In the case of Matthew 12, 23, the Greek particle corresponding to the word not is, it is in the text. None of the lesser Cambridge editions from the 1630s add the word not back into the verse. All the pre-1611 English Bibles read not in this verse. So that would be Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthews, Geneva, Great Bible, Bishop's Bible. They all say not in that verse. Okay? And there is no evidence of emendation recorded for the word not in Bod 1602. So here's Bod 1602. Notice there's a change here from that. That is crossed through and it's changed to the, but notice, is not this the son of David? So is there any emendation recorded in Bod 1602 to remove the word not?
No.
There is not any emendation there, right? So there's no evidence of emendation recorded to the word not in BOD 1602. So let me just say something, okay? This is an example of why the BOD document remains to some still a mystery. And here's why. If this BOD document was simply recording changes that had already been made to the King James, why did they not record a change where? There. Okay? So there's an example of where there is no edit in BOD. If BOD had been produced after the 1611 had been printed, then you would expect to see an edit there because the word not isn't in the 1611. Okay? But there seem to be other places in the BOD document where maybe the reverse is true, which has led some to some ambiguities in the minds of some regarding, you know, the purpose of it, when it was created, who created it, and what was the reasons for it. So I would simply say then, in the case of, I would conclude that the omission of the word not is a printer error. I don't think it was necessarily anything the translators wanted changed. Because all the pre-1611 evidence suggests that the word not should be there. The Greek text suggests that the word not should be there. It was in the source text, and then all of a sudden it's not in the 1611. So it appears that that is the correction of what? A printer error, okay? So you have to judge these things, it seems to me, based upon the evidence that exists, right? And then we got time, I think, for just one brief one here, which is the last one on 1 John. So here's another one, 1 John 5:12. Notice the 1602 bishops, okay? And he that hath not the Son, notice of whom? God. Of God hath not life. Look at the 1611, okay? And he that hath not the Son hath not life. What's not in the 1611?
Of God.
Of God, okay? Look at the 1638, okay? And he that hath not the Son of God hath not what? Life. Go first, get 1 John chapter 5, verse 12 in your Bible. First John chapter 5. Look at verse 12. He that hath the Son hath life. He that hath not the Son of God hath what? Does yours say Son of God?
No.
That's the standard reading, okay? All the following lesser Cambridge editions from the 1630s contain the reading Son of God, along with one Edinburgh edition from 1633. Once again, this is a case where scholars did not give accurate information because they only collated the large Cambridge folio editions from 1629 and 1638. So all of these, 1630, 1631, 33, 33, the Edinburgh one, other Cambridge ones from 35 and 37, they all have the phrase Son of God. Okay? So insertion of that phrase happened in a lesser edition, not in one of the folio editions. So let's just look at the last point here and we'll conclude. The Textus Receptus has the word theos in the text. That's the Greek word for God. All pre-1611 English Bibles, including the 1602 Bishop's Bible, that served as the base text for the AV, contained the phrase of God in 1 John 5:12. Therefore, the evidence points in the direction of a printer's error in terms of its omission from the 1611. It does not appear to be an intentional translational choice of the King James translators, but what?
A printer error.
Okay? So, we are right on the mark as far as time goes.